Festival, the Adrian Arts Center for the Performing Arts runs now through July 6th. This may be your chance to laugh your way into summer. You'll see 10 of some of the nation's hottest award-winning short plays on one stage in one night. Roger Martin warns, caution, you may hurt yourself laughing. Summer shorts may be the most fun you'll have at the theater this summer. Tickets at 305-949-6722 or arschcenter.org. Support for NPR comes from Zurich, providing risk management and insurance solutions for those who truly love their business. Learn more at zurichna.com.
And a very good afternoon to you. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman, and Joseph Cooper is still recovering from his severe back injury and appreciates your kind wishes and your support. A series of ecological catastrophes in the 1960s placed Florida in the vanguard of the burgeoning environmental revolution. As the nation ushered in a wave of revolutionary legislation, Marjorie Harris Carr was one of the most effective leaders of a powerful contingent of citizen activists who opposed dredging a canal across the state that would threaten an ecologically rich river valley. Under Carr's leadership, Free the Oklawaha became a rallying cry for environmentalists throughout the country. Joining us now is educator, author, and public speaker with a special interest in Florida's natural environment, Peggy McDonald. She's written Marjorie Harris Carr, Defender of Florida's Environment. Peggy McDonald, a native Floridian, and speaks with us from Gainesville. Welcome to you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bonnie, for having me.
It's great to have you. Peggy, I was so unaware of all this in your book about Marjorie Harris Carr. So she's an extraordinary woman. How did you come to know of her and write about her?
Well, I was actually born in Gainesville, and my mother grew up with Mimi Carr, who was the daughter of Marjorie Carr and her husband Archie Carr, the famous sea turtle conservation biologist. And my mother was actually in Marjorie Carr's Girl Scout troop. She was a troop leader. So I always grew up hearing the stories of Marjorie Carr and her efforts to stop the barge canal and Archie Carr and the turtles. And to me, it seemed so close that I didn't even realize what a great topic would be until I was in my PhD program at the University of Florida here in Gainesville. And Jack Davis had just come to UF to teach environmental history. And he suggested to a room full of new graduate students that Marjorie Carr would be a great topic. And it was so close to me, it hadn't occurred to me at the time. So I had a wonderful connection to Mimi Carr, who is their eldest child and their only daughter. And she allowed me to look at papers and books and photos that had never been seen before that without Mimi Carr's help, this really couldn't have happened.
I was going to mention this much later in the program, but I'm just wondering, you know, we have the three Marjories. We have Marjorie Rawlings and we have Marjorie Stoneman Douglas along with Marjorie Harris Carr. Why do you think they're so much better known than Marjorie Harris Carr?
Well, of course, Rawlings won the Pulitzer Prize for The Yearling.
Right.
And then with Stoneman Douglas forming Friends of the Everglades and writing The River of Grass in 1947, I think because of their prominent literature, that's part of the reason. Another reason is that unlike Rawlings, who was a divorcee without children, and Stoneman Douglas, who was married once and decided that was enough and didn't remarry, Marjorie Harris Carr was married to Archie Carr. They had five children together. So she fit into that model that what a lot of historians have referred to of this culture of Cold War conformity in the 1950s, the stereotypical American housewife, when in reality she was a scientist. So she was a gifted writer, but really her main strength was understanding the ecology of Florida. So she kind of liked to stay behind the scenes and use corral experts to do the work, but stay behind the scenes and not be as much of a public figure as certainly Stoneman Douglas was and Rawlings through her writing.
Right. Well, let's talk about Marjorie Harris Carr. She was born in Boston in 1915, but her family picked up and came to rural Southwest Florida 3 years later. What prompted the move?
That's right. Marjorie Harris's father, Charles Harris, and mother, Clara Harris, decided almost on a whim to move to Florida with some other groups of Boston families and grow oranges. So they were part of this larger Florida dream that Gary Mormino writes a lot about the idea that Florida promoters depicted this image of Florida as an Edenic paradise with sunshine and orange juice. And the Harris family launched the seize upon that, moved down to very rural Bonita Springs near Fort Myers, and purchased a 10-acre orange grove, and Charles Harris built a cracker-style house. And it provided Marjorie Harris with a wonderful naturalist upbringing. Her parents are very educated. Her father was trained in the law at Dartmouth. They were both teachers and naturalists. And so she had this unique perspective on really being immersed in relatively undeveloped nature in 1918, and then witnessing the effects of Florida's rapid overpopulation, or at least increase in population, over the 20th century.
Yeah, it's hard to think of it as, you know, such a big population when we consider what it is today and what it's going to be.
Exactly.
As we look ahead. So anything else about her childhood or her years in Bonita Springs? Did she stay there through her teens? Did they stay there with the and have the orange grove through her teens?
That's a good question. Unfortunately, Bonita Springs at the time only had about 175 residents. So the school, the one school in Bonita Springs, only went up to the eighth grade. So when it was time to start high school, the Harrises moved to Fort Myers, and then tragedy struck. Charles Harris, Marjorie's father, died when she was only 15, suddenly from a stroke. And this is during the Great Depression, and this was just a few months shy of when his pension from teaching would have come in. So the family had only a little bit in savings, and then there was a series of bank failures, of course, during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
So they were completely on their own financially. And Marjorie Harris wanted nothing more than to go to college. She got what was considered a small fortune at the time. An aunt died and left her $500, and it financed her first year at Florida State College for Women in Tallahassee, and that really helped make her a career in science.
Now, she got her bachelor's degree in zoology from that college, but I read that she was denied funding or admission to graduate programs in zoology or ornithology because of her gender. So if you could speak about the challenges faced by her and other scientists in the early to mid-20th century.
It's a really fascinating thing. At Florida State College for Women, unlike a lot of Southern women's colleges that were slightly more finishing schools, Florida State College for Women had a liberal arts path, and in fact, it was the first state university in Florida to get a Phi Beta Kappa charter. So it trumped UF that way. And Marjorie Harris graduated Phi Beta Kappa. She was a Sigma Psi in the Honor Society. She was a charter member of the Florida Academy of Sciences. But in 1936, she was denied admission to Cornell University of North Carolina based upon her gender. And the head of the Cornell Ornithology Department told her flat out, women were not welcome in the field. So at this point, if you were a woman with a PhD, a male with a bachelor's degree would automatically outrank you in science because of the tendency to funnel any woman interested in science into home economics. That was the only acceptable field for women scientists.
So what did she do after she got her undergraduate degree? What position did she take?
She was a lucky recipient of a New Deal program through the federal administration. She had an opportunity to be the first female federal wildlife technician. But when I was going through a series of love letters that Mimi Carr shared with me that Archie and Marjorie wrote to each other in the first half year of their courtship and their elopement and their secret marriage, they had to keep it hidden because female scientists who were married were expected to stop working. Through these letters, I discovered that Marjorie Harris was promptly fired from that position because her boss was not comfortable working with a woman scientist.
Oh my, as the wildlife technician?
Yes, and this was at the Wallaca Fish Hatchery near the St. Johns River in northern Florida.
So talk more about Archie Carr. He was a fellow scientist. Tell us more about him, how they met, and tell us about that courtship and why they eloped to the Everglades.
Well, Marjorie Harris had just graduated from Florida State College for Women. She'd been working for a few months in Wallaca, and she, as part of her duties at the fish hatchery, she worked at an aviary, and there were some quail that were suffering some unknown ailment, and she had a theory that they had a disease that was actually a chicken disease, and she didn't have the facilities at Wallaca to test for this. So she convinced her employer to let her, he didn't want her doing anything during office hours, so she had to go at night on her own expense, drive a few hours to west to the University of Florida in Gainesville, which was still all male. So imagine a 21-year-old female scientist in 1936 arriving with a box of six quail and all these young male scientists at a men's school seeing her at a toiling away at a microscope. It was really quite a sight.
How was she received by the other students?
Well, apparently it was love at first sight, not just for Archie Carr, but Horton Hobbs was a friend of his, and he came back and reported to Archie that this lovely Miss Harris, the most beautiful woman he'd ever met, was down there working at the biology lab. And so Archie got himself all spruced up, went down to work on his dissertation. They met, and it was love at first sight, and they were partners for more than 50 years in science and raising a family and really exciting love affair, what those letters reveal.
So how did she manage, and why did they elope to the Everglades? I guess that was the natural place for two scientists and to go.
Well, there's a fun story. It's a tragedy, and it's fun all at the same time. Right after Marjorie was fired from her position at the Wallaca Fish Hatchery, there was a mad dash for employment, because even though they had a whirlwind courtship and Archie proposed, he didn't want her to marry him just out of the sense of financial duress, and he couldn't afford to support her. He made $40 a month during the Depression. He was barely scraping by on his own, so she had to remain employed, and again, if they got married openly, if it was not a secret, she was not employable as a woman scientist who would be married. So he wrote to a connection in Englewood at the Bass Lab, where Jack Bass ran a zoological research supply where they would collect specimens from cockroaches to alligators and ship them up north to Harvard and all the best schools for research. And Marjorie Harris was Marjorie Harris Carr, was employed as a field technician, so she concealed her her marriage while she was working there. But the elopement to the Everglades, there's a really funny story that you'd have to see in the book about how they convinced Marjorie Harris's mother. They were staying. Archie drove down from Gainesville to Fort Myers and was staying with them. They said they were going to look at the moonlight, and they actually went to the Everglades, woke up Judge Platt, got married, and came back. And in the end, Marjorie spent the night in her mother's bed on her wedding night.
Oh my, not quite the honeymoon, not quite the romantic honeymoon.
No, I think most young men don't want to spend their wedding night with their mother-in-law in
bed. No,
and he didn't.
She was there alone.
Yes.
We're speaking with Peggy McDonald. She's an educator, author, public speaker, editor, photographer, and she has a special interest in Florida's natural environment. And she's been an adjunct professor of history at Stetson University for the last 2 years. And I guess in about a week and a half, you'll be moving to an assistant professorship of history at Florida Polytech University in Lakeland.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Well, good for you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
We're speaking about her book, Marjorie Harris Carr, Defender of Florida's Environment, on today's Topical Currents. Let's take a short break, and we'll return in a moment.
It can be tough finding a job these days. It's even harder if you're young.
I've done from call centers to casinos to customer service.
A human resources position, any kind of office management, and it's just the opportunity is not there.
I'm Renee Montaigne. What's making the job market so hard for young people to crack on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Join us for the next edition of Morning Edition, starting at 5 a.m. tomorrow here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. You're listening to Topical Currents.
From 63 feet below the ocean surface, 9 miles off the coast of Key Largo, Jacques Cousteau's grandson has been leading a month-long mission to live and work underwater. Fabien Cousteau's home has been FIU's underwater marine laboratory, the Aquarius. Thursday morning at 9, WLRN Miami Herald News will host a live web chat with Cousteau after emerging from the underwater lab. You can join that conversation at WLRN.org, 9 o'clock Thursday morning. Tweet your questions to @WLRN.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman visiting with Peggy McDonald. She's written Marjorie Harris Carr, Defender of Florida's Environment. If you have questions for Peggy McDonald or comments, maybe you know about Marjorie Harris Carr, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576 or email radio@wlrn.org. So, Peggy, how did Marjorie Harris Carr manage to complete her master's degree in zoology at the University of Florida, which was still officially an all-male institution? Did Archie help her out there?
Yes. This is this interesting development where, on the one hand, Marjorie Harris Carr was hindered by, her career was hindered by marrying as a scientist, but because she married a fellow scientist and a University of Florida professor, she had the advantage of having an in into the graduate program. Mm. And another advantage that would really help Carr later on in her activist career is that she did research out in the field and in the lab with colleagues at the University of Florida who later she would call upon to support her various causes. So in addition to restoring and protecting the Ocklawaha River, she would call upon these colleagues who were experts in science and really understood the ecology back when ecology was still a new term, and use that. And then she had a talent for writing about these complex ecological issues in clear terms and then using the media to educate the public and public servants and to really cajole people into doing what was right for the environment.
And she did it very effectively. So they moved to the Honduras, to Central America in the mid-1940s. Why was that? Was that because Archie's business took him there?
Yes, Archie had an opportunity. He was a very close, I guess you could say that Thomas Barber was his tutor in a way and really embraced him. There's a wonderful book written by Frederick Davis, biography of Archie Carr, called The Man Who Saved Sea Turtles, and it talks about the wonderful connection, the intellectual and financial benefits Archie received from his close friendship with Thomas Barber. But Barber intervened and helped get a position for Archie Carr teaching at the Escuela at Zamorano. It's an agricultural school in tropical Honduras. And Marjorie had just given birth to her first child, and who was a toddler, and then waited in America to give birth in an American hospital to her second child, Chuck. And then when he was a newborn, they flew down to Honduras. And while they were in Honduras, Marjorie had two more children, but she also benefited from the cheap labor of having Honduran nanny and laundress and cook and gardener. So she and Archie, whenever he could, when he wasn't teaching, would go do research and explore the cloud forests of Honduras. Archie, herpetologist, and Marjorie, an ornithologist. So she did a lot of research during the day, and she knew what a great life she had. She wrote her mother about what an amazing life it was to come home with the children fed, bathed, and in bed, a warm fire and dinner waiting. And it was a great experience being in Honduras.
So she was able to have a career even with having four children. That's really something, especially for that time.
In Honduras, it was great. Ornithology was slow to professionalize, so there were still some opportunities for women who could kind of sneak in the cracks. And so she was able to publish her findings. She published with J.C. Dickinson, who became the head of the Florida Museum of Natural History in Gainesville. And then later in 1995, she finally published her extensive study of the birds of Honduras because she was so busy with her activist career that she really didn't have time until the 90s to get around to a full comprehensive publication.
Wow, she waited 50 years almost to publish them. That's something. So they returned to Florida. I guess they were there 4 years in 1949. And they built this rural home in Micanopy. Tell us about Micanopy, where it is, why did they go there, and how would you describe it in 1949?
Archie Carr had, he wrote in his letters that he always hated cities on principle. He and Marjorie had a shared connection to rural Florida. The Carr family moved to Umatilla in the 1930s and were hunters and really explored the rural environment. And of course, Marjorie had that connection with being in rural Bonita Springs and Fort Myers when it was still undeveloped. So they wanted, after he finished his dissertation, to live somewhere a little away from things. And Micanopy is just across Payne's Prairie from Gainesville. And Payne's Prairie is one of Marjorie Carr's land preservation projects. If you drive on I-75 north from Ocala to Gainesville or US 441, you're surrounded by this amazing open prairie wetlands, which actually the restored park has bison, a variety of flora and fauna. It's really breathtaking. So Micanopy was featured in the movie Doc Hollywood because it's so well preserved. There's a historic downtown with cascading live oaks and antique stores and a little ice cream parlor, and there was a wonderful unair-conditioned bookstore that unfortunately recently closed, O'Briskie Books. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. the owner just died. But the Micanopy, on Micanopy, the Carrs had a homestead that was this nature retreat, and they purchased it and built a house there for the whole point of allowing Archie Carr to write. And he was a prolific nature writer in addition to being a good conservation biologist and won many prizes for his nature writing. And he also wrote a wonderful little book, Time Life Books, back before the internet used to publish a series of wonderful books with color photo spreads. And his book on the Everglades is a wonderful introduction for people who want to understand the science of it. But it's written in a way that he personifies animals and insects and even plants. So he had a real gift for nature writing. And being in Micanopy, surrounded by wilderness, this really undeveloped Florida wilderness, was central to that writing experience.
Hmm. So when, under what circumstances, I was thinking, you know, Marjorie became this environmental activist, but I was wondering if you thought her fight for gender equality stoked her career as an activist. I mean, she was already a fighter.
That's a great way to describe her, as a fighter. She had this overwhelming sense of optimism. She was faced with these awful challenges, starting with the tragedy of losing her father when she was only 15, and then being unable to pursue a formal career in science because of her gender. She never gave up. She always found a way. And her activist career, starting out with at the local level, at really what's considered approved for women. Women in the early to mid-20th century, women through the women's clubs and the gardens clubs, were activists outside the home in an acceptable way. And so her activist career started that way, with town beautification, working to preserve 1,000 live oaks in Micanopy and thereby preserving that historic downtown, then working on Payne's Prairie and turning into a state park and preserve, also preserving Lake Alice. Any University of Florida alumni would remember Lake Alice. It's this beautiful little wilderness nook on the UF campus, which is one of the only places in Gainesville where you can see an alligator or an egret in its native environment. And the University of Florida almost drained it and paved it and built a 2,000-car parking lot and four-lane throughway right over Lake Alice back in the 1970s. And Carr and others stood up and protected it. So this is, on the one hand, it appears to be an acceptable form of activism for a woman who's married to a respected scientist and writer and mother of 5 children, but at the same time is definitely, she's a fighter. And this really started in her own backyard in Micanopy when a portion of I-75 was constructed literally through her backyard.
And what did she do?
At first, this is very conservative time. She first heard about this in the late 50s. The construction was completed in the early 60s. Her view was that she would go forward to a judge and make the case that her husband purchased this property to as a nature retreat, mm-hmm. to inspire his nature writing, and that building an interstate through it was not consistent with the nature retreat, and that he should at least be compensated at a higher rate than the rate established for peanut farmers, which is what they were going to be paid. The judge was not interested. And she learned an important lesson. She tried to act alone to accomplish a really major environmental feat, which would be rerouting construction of an interstate highway. Later, she had 2 more successful projects with stopping road construction projects where she would work through organized groups such as Alatra Audubon Society, which she co-founded, or other established groups at the state and national level. And this is what a lot of women activists did in the 20th century, working with the Garden Club, the Women's Club, and then various nature groups from Audubon up to more specialized single-issue campaigns like Florida Defenders of Environment that she founded in 1969, and it shielded women. You know, it strengthened and shielded them as they pursued activist careers.
And are Florida Defenders of the Environment, or is Florida Defenders of the Environment still active? Are they still an active force today?
They sure are, and in fact, they've just launched an energetic campaign. They have a brand new executive director, Karen Allers, who remembers watching Rodman Dam constructed, and she described the view she had through her school bus window going to high school back in 1968 when the dam was under construction. She described it as being like a war zone. She's the new executive director, and she's been very successful in working to help convince the Florida Department of Environmental Protection to more thoroughly investigate water permits, including for an Adena Springs Ranch proposal to have a massive cattle farm and slaughterhouse in the watershed of Silver Springs. FDE has also launched a new campaign, public information campaign, to try to get FDE's history out and educate people about the effects of Rodman Dam on the Ocklawaha. It's now known as Kirkpatrick Dam, after George Kirkpatrick.
Boy, there's so much that she did. It's such a coincidence that these three Marjories, Marjorie Harris Carr, Marjorie Rawlings, and of course Everglades activist Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, all wrote about and all lived in Florida. What was their association, or did they know one another? Did they work together?
That's a good question. Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings died in 1953, and Marjorie Carr moved back to the Gainesville-Micanopy area in 1949. I can't find any records that they knew each other. I can say that Rawlings would go into Micanopy to use the phone, because when she was at Cross Creek, which is about 10 miles from Micanopy, there wasn't even a phone. It was so remote, and that's what made her writing so popular, that she really characterized the Florida cracker experience and gave dignity to the native Floridians of the area and their way of life. In terms of Stoneman Douglas, she and Carr became friends, and they worked together professionally on conservation, environmental protection issues, public education. They spoke together. And Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, of course, had a much longer life. She died at, I think, age 108 in 1998, and Marjorie Carr died in 1997 at age 82. But they both shared that long perspective of the 20th century, and not only witnessed profound environmental damage, but then worked to slow the process down and educate the public about the importance of protecting nature, even if it's already damaged.
Well, as we're going to get to, I just want to say we're speaking with Peggy McDonald. She's an educator and author, and her latest book is Marjorie Harris Carr, Defender of Florida's Environment. If you want to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email is radio@wlrn.org. Well, let's go to the 1960s, when the Army Corps of Engineers embarked on these projects in Florida, including that Cross Florida Barge Canal. And I saw it was known as the Wicked Ditch. And this was already in progress. So tell us what it was and describe what happened to the project.
Well, there's a good history of the canal itself written by Steve Knoll and David Tegeter, called The Ditch of Dreams, that focuses on that, the long-standing dream to circumvent the dangerous route around the Florida Keys. And the barge canal was the Corps of Engineers' plan to, it was going to be a 107-mile canal that would connect the Gulf of Mexico to the Atlantic Ocean. And it was originally started in Florida in the 1930s as a public works project to help get money into workers who could then distribute money to their families during the Great Depression. At the time, Archie Carr actually use the power of the pen to try to stop it. Work did stop because World War II started, and there was no extra money for pork barrel projects like this. Then the Congress, a bunch of people called the Pork Chop Gang, special interest and the Corps of Engineers pushed for this project, and then finally it was authorized, and then 20 years went by where no work was done on it. And then in 1962, Marjorie Carr Heard, through a fellow friend, a clubwoman who was in the Florida Federation of Garden Clubs, that the barge canal was proposed to go through the Ocklawaha River. So she had an ecological understanding of what the effects would be if that were the case. And she and her some fellow scientists at the University of Florida, who were citizen activists, started investigating first under Alatra Audubon Society and later 1969 through Florida Defenders of the Environment, which was a collection of volunteer scientists, economists, and experts in the law. And Marjorie Carr was a real arm twister who knew how to gather these various experts and then put them to work. So the fascinating thing about Marjorie Carr is that she came to Florida in 1918 at a time when women couldn't even vote. And by the time she was active with FDE, she was able to influence policy at the highest level. Richard Nixon would read her letters and took her advice under consideration and ultimately called for a halt, an injunction to stop construction of the barge canal. So it's an amazing lifespan in Florida.
So what is the condition of the Ocklawaha River and Valley today? Where does it stand? They started to build this canal. What happened to it?
Well, it's a real tragedy. Unfortunately, Rodman Dam, now known as Kirkpatrick Dam, still exists at the Ocklawaha. And the Ocklawaha is a beautiful wild river, but it's tiny and it's not as well known. Everybody's heard about the Everglades.
Mm-hmm.
Most people have heard, in Florida at least, about the Kissimmee River that the Corps of Engineers channelized at the same time that they were working on the barge canal project. Today, the remnants of the barge canal remain. The Rodman Dam continues to stop manatee, West Indian manatee, and Atlantic and short-nosed sturgeon from migrating to the St. John's River. There's also a very small but very vocal group of bass fishermen who value the artificial pool that's constructed in connection with the dam. And this is Rodman Reservoir. And George Kirkpatrick and others were so vocal over the years and made sure they stopped year after year. Every Florida governor from Reuben Askew through Charlie Crist supported restoration of the Ocklawaha. It's the official state policy, but it has always failed to come through, usually because of a handful of local politicians who support keeping this reservoir for bass fishing. Ironically, fishing is not very good anymore in Rodman. The largest fish tend to be around 15 pounds, where in the Ocklawaha River in the 1950s, before Rodman Dam was constructed, you could get striped bass that were up to 30 pounds. So fishing would improve with restoration, but those who support keeping Rodman Dam are adamant that it stay.
Mm. So can anything be done about that?
Well, I do hope that somehow this book might play a part in helping raise awareness of the Ocklawaha. Restoration of the Ocklawaha would be relatively simple and cheap compared to the restoration of the Kissimmee River and the restoration of the Everglades. Of course, with the comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, which was developed in 1999, the idea was that it would take 30 to 40 years and billions of dollars to restore the Everglades. There's no exact estimate for restoration of the Ocklawaha, but it would be somewhere in the millions and just a fraction of the cost of restoration of the Kissimmee. Very practical. And the first step, of course, is to remove Rodman Dam. Most people believe that there will have to be a court decision. It's going to have to come from the judicial level because at the level of the legislators, it so far, unfortunately, just hasn't happened.
Do you have any plans on becoming an activist, Peggy?
Well, you know, environmental history is choosing to write environmental history,
I guess that's, yeah.
It really is almost a choice to be an activist. I can tell you from the perspective of the job hunt, there were people who were very reluctant to the idea of, you know, hiring somebody who had written a book about the a woman who championed restoration of the Ocklawaha and who fought to preserve the environment in Florida. There's just a contrasting world view that still remains over whether the earth is a collection of resources to be used for human benefit, mm-hmm. or whether we need to preserve it and work to restore things to something closer to a natural system, especially in Florida, which our economy is tied to that image of paradise. And yet we're stepping up oil drilling efforts and exploration into alternative forms of oil drilling, including potentially fracking. And so it's an issue of, I think, raising awareness and getting the citizens involved. Marjorie Carr believed very firmly that when the public speaks up for an issue, the public will get what it wants.
How instrumental were the Florida Defenders of the Environment and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas's Friends of the Everglades in preventing a lot of these projects from coming to fruition?
It's amazing just how much, if you look at just those two women who were not even Florida natives, they were transplants, but how much they were able to accomplish to preserve Florida's remaining wildlife and wild places. And one thing they have in common that I think led to that, you were talking about Marjorie Carr being a fighter, is Carr and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas were graduates of women's colleges. Marjorie Kenan Rawlings actually went to University of Wisconsin, that was an early university to experiment with co-education. But Douglas went to Wellesley, and Carr went to Florida State College for Women, and they had really solid liberal arts education. And I have to say, I'm a women's college graduate. There's something about that experience in shaping women to be leaders. I went to Hollins University, and that was the bumper sticker at the time and the mantra, Hollins women go places. They trained us to be leaders. And I do wonder if that contributed to their willingness to stand up for what they thought was right and for fight for Florida.
And preserve Florida. I mean, Florida would be a very different place today if it weren't for the two of them.
It's really mind-boggling when you think about it. If, in the case of Marjorie Carr, if she had not had parents who chose to follow the Florida dream, move to Florida, grow oranges, she wouldn't have come. Then I do have to wonder, would Payne's Prairie be here? Would it be developed? Would Lake Alice have become a parking lot? Mm. Would the Ocklawaha, would the Barge Canal have been completed?
Right.
And, downtown historic Micanopy. Now, maybe some people think these are small things that are not worth fighting for, but this is one woman's legacy in north central Florida that everyone sees as they drive by I-75. There's the land bridge, the Marjorie Harris Carr Cross Florida Greenway, this large swath of biodiversity preserve is there. That's the remnants of what would have been the Barge Canal. And, of course, in the case of Douglas, she was 79 at the time that she was approached to become the head of Friends of the Everglades. And it was that clout she had as a writer and that moral authority she had as a leader that she went ahead and said, yes, I'll do this. And I think Florida has a wonderful tradition of men and women working well past the age of retirement to try to make a change, make a difference.
We're speaking with Peggy McDonald, and her book is Marjorie Harris Carr, Defender of Florida's Environment, on today's Topical Currents. Please stay with us. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
I'm Robin Young. Qatar negotiated that trade of Taliban detainees for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, but what about other Americans being held hostage overseas?
It would naturally lead all the families to wonder, can we indeed negotiate with terrorists to make a swap or to get someone out?
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBR Boston.
Join us for Here and Now in just 15 minutes at 2 o'clock here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM in the Florida Keys. Good afternoon to you. I'm Lorenzo Bonza de Leon in for Paul Leary. If you're a business owner and want to raise awareness about your company, sponsoring programs on WLRN can help. Our media research will surprise you. For more information, call Michael Payton at 305-350-7978.
I'm Ashley Milne-Tite. Later today on The Broad Experience, what transgender men's lives in the workplace can tell us about how women are viewed at work. That's The Broad Experience this Tuesday at 5:50 p.m. during All Things Considered on WLRN.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Fani Berman with Peggy McDonald. She's an educator, author, public speaker, editor, photographer, and she's written Marjorie Harris Carr, Defender of Florida's Environment. You write that in 1962, when Marjorie Carr first learned of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' plans to build the Cross Florida Barge Canal, she was 47. So she was 47, she had five children. How did she balance her career or her activism with her role as a wife and mother? Because she was still that.
It is an incredible thing. We love to talk today about multitasking.
Right.
Imagine 47, five children, and taking on this David and Goliath environmental campaign. But when she was really active in the movement to, at first it was a movement not to kill the canal, but to reroute the Cross Florida Barge Canal away from the Ocklawaha River. Later, she embraced the terms of ecology and conveyed them to the public through using the press. And she was able to do this and manage her family and her husband. Her children, by this point, most of them had left the home. David Carr, the youngest, was at home at this time, and he would help out in terms of taking people on canoe trips down the Ocklawaha. There was so much that could be done through communications, letter writing, grassroots environmental campaign, using the telephone. She loved to say the centers of power are only a phone call away. Mm. So she was able to multitask. Now, meanwhile, Archie Carr was literally traveling the world, going to Africa, Costa Rica, the Caribbean, in terms of establishing a research station and exploring the migratory patterns of turtles. So a combination research and conservation program, and writing books. So he was very driven, very busy, and Marjorie Carr was equally driven and busy, but she had to find a way to balance both worlds, being a loving wife and mother to five children and fighting for something she believed in.
Now, did you speak with any of her other children? You said you spoke with Mimi Carr to write this and to get access to a lot of the papers. Did you meet any of the other children?
Yes, and Chuck Carr is the second eldest, and he also was active in environmentalism. In fact, all the Carr children were. He was very helpful, too, and looked, gave me some notes on the manuscript. And David Carr still lives in Micanopy, and he and his wife, Peggy, run a little gas station and convenience store with a wonderful barbecue called Pearl, and it's a real institution. Mind you, Micanopy has one stoplight. They refer to the stoplight. And Pearl is right across from the stoplight. And it's wonderful. It's barbecue and also a great collection of natural history books.
And is he, too, involved in preservation or conservation?
Yes.
Yes,
he founded a conservation trust for Florida, and for a long time he was working with his father's organization, the Caribbean Conservation Corporation, which is now the Sea Turtle Conservancy. And the entire Carr clan has been active. Mimi Carr recently did a voiceover for a video project that Bill Belville did. Bill Belville writes some wonderful books on nature through the naturalist perspective and is also a filmmaker, and his nature photography it's a little vignette on the Ocala National Forest on a hunting cabin that Archie Carr and Tom Carr used to frequent with their father, and it was converted, and it's compared to a cabin that would have been like Thoreau spent time in the woods. Archie Carr and his brother Tom spent time in this little hunting shack, and it was really their introduction to the beauty and the wonder of the world around them.
You know, before we get to the end, I would want you to talk about that other project that was slated for construction in the 1960s. And I think that Marjorie also had a hand in preventing that one, the Everglades Airport or something that was supposed to be bigger than JFK.
That is featured in Jack Davis's wonderful biography of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. It's called An Everglades Providence, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in the American Environmental Century. And the Everglades jet port was billed as the largest jet port in the world. It would be, three times the size of JFK, the largest runways in the world that could handle the largest jumbo jets. Mm. And the idea was to turn the Everglades jet port into a massive hub. This is right around the time that Disney World was under construction. Disney World opened in 71. The jet port crisis culminated in 1969. And this is when Florida is really cooking in terms of becoming a hub of international tourism. And the growth was just completely unregulated, and nobody thought twice about whether this was a good idea. It was actually, construction actually began on runways in the middle of the Everglades, but this is where the very first major environmental impact statement took place. It was to study the effects of this jet port on the Everglades, and it was right around this time that Douglas was recruited to lead the Friends of the Everglades. Mm-hmm. And again, there's much more on that in Jack Davis's book, which is more than 700 pages long.
Right. You wrote an email to me speaking so passionately of the Everglades, and at one point you spoke of the original Everglades system and its size, and then you added, after about a century's worth of burning, digging canals, and building dikes, the Everglades is now less than half of its original size. What is the state of the Everglades right now? Where is the restoration project? I mean, where does it stand?
That's a great question, and unfortunately, restoration is proceeding at a snail's pace. To think about the Everglades, we often think Everglades National Park, but that's actually just a very small portion of the overall Everglades ecosystem. And I love looking at Archie Carr's book on the Everglades because it has some wonderful photo essays as well. But you could really envision all of South Florida as the Everglades, from just south of present-day Orlando at the headwaters of the Kissimmee River all the way to Florida Bay. So we like to think of Florida, I mean, we probably think first of people in Florida, and we think of all the cities in South Florida, but really we are sharing this space with the Everglades. The slow pace of restoration, the Corps of Engineers made headlines in the spring for wanting more time to look over a report that it had actually partnered in on restoration, on the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, and the 8,000-page report. So the Corps of Engineers was criticized for being the one agency to slow down this influx of about $2 billion for restoration. And Governor Rick Scott pled with the Corps of Engineers to go ahead and approve it. Major organizations, conservation organizations, government organizations were urging them to do it, but they dug in their heels. And yet, really, if you were to look at this, someone writing a history of this 50, 100 years from now, the idea that we would put the Corps of Engineers in charge of restoration when it was their master plan for development in Florida that led to the barge canal, the current state of Lake Okeechobee and Kissimmee River, the Everglades. It's really bizarre.
So why their reluctance to go ahead with this? What are they waiting for?
That's a good question. I wish we could maybe get a call or something that to hear. I can't think of a good explanation for why there should be any more delay.
You also speak of the problem of the ever-increasing population of Florida and the impact it has on the fragile ecosystems. What do you think can be done about that? Do you have any proposals for coping with that?
You know, when Marjorie Carr moved to Florida, the population of Florida in 1918 was under a million residents. And then by 1960, it was about 5 million. By 1980, about 10 million. And we're pushing 20 million now, so we're poised to become the third most populous state in the nation now. Now, no one's suggesting that people stop from coming to Florida. In fact, our economic development model has always been based upon continued growth. Mm-hmm. But there are new forms of, for instance, there's a new urbanism, form of land development and architecture, the idea that we can build we can develop in a more intelligent way rather than promoting sprawl, for instance, promoting developments that build up instead of out. And rather than viewing this unending water crisis that Cynthia Barnett is a wonderful author who writes about water and the idea that really the crisis is human-made, that we are putting our groundwater, most of our groundwater is going to agriculture and to our lawns, and that we need to rethink. So no one's saying put the brakes on population expansion, but you know, we need to educate the public and rethink how we live with the environment, in particular in South Florida, how people and Everglades can function together.
Peggy, do you have a website?
Oh, yes. It's peggymacdonald.com, and it's M-A-C-D, peggymacdonald.com.
M-A-C-D-O-N-A-L-D, and it's just M-A-C, just one word. It's not a M-C.
Right.
.com. Okay. Well, we'll have a link to your website and to the book, which we've been discussing, which is Marjorie Harris Carr, Defender of Florida's Environment. Been speaking with Peggy MacDonald. She's an educator, author, public speaker, editor, photographer. Are you a nature photographer, Peggy?
I love to photograph nature. I do. I'm not anywhere like a John Moran, who is one of the best photographers in Florida. I have a puny camera, but I love to go outside with it.
Well, she's also been a history at Stetson University for the last 2 years, and on July 11th, she'll be an assistant professor of history at Florida Polytechnic University in Lakeland. Peggy MacDonald, it's been informative. It's been really inspiring and interesting. So we thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The name of the book is Marjorie Harris Carr, Defender of Florida's Environment. And thank you so much for spending your time with us today. Our producer is Richard Ives with technical direction from Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. Our online producer is Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. And more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. We'll have some fun on tomorrow's Topical Currents. We visit with Mitchell Kaplan from Books and Books and co-founder of the Miami Book Fair International. He'll give us his picks for our summer reading. And we also want to hear about your favorite books and what's on your summer reading list. Bonnie Berman joining you, sending best wishes to Joseph Cooper, hoping your day is a great one. Stay